A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of The Group Chat. I'm Zara. I'm joined in studio by Richard.
Hi.
And Gavin.
Yo.
Hello, how are you?
Not too bad, how are you?
Good. Busy week in news.
Yeah, a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. And I think we're going to just jump straight into the discussion about what exactly it is happening in Gaza. Richard, so many people are listening to the podcast, you might be following on the periphery, will have heard the word ceasefire, but it's not quite the case.
No, it's not. Israel has not signed up to any sort of ceasefire. There was a big announcement I think it was actually on Bank Holiday Monday. Hamas announced that it had signed up to a ceasefire proposal put forward by Egypt and Qatar, who have obviously been brokering and mediating these very protracted go-nowhere ceasefire negotiations all the way through. That sparked jubilation in places like Rafah, where, you know, there was footage on Al Jazeera of women weeping with joy at basically their salvation, as they thought it was, arriving. Within a matter of probably a couple of short hours, that was being dashed. You had right-wing Israeli ministers saying that this is all a big ruse by Hamas, that we haven't signed up to any deal, that this is all, you know, Hamas trying to avoid Rafah being seized by Israel. The Israeli government, well, Netanyahu himself has kind of put a little bit more of a softer approach on it. He sent a negotiation team to these talks. But effectively, what's actually at issue here for Netanyahu is the word ceasefire itself. Okay. What Israel is going to try and negotiate is what's called a sustainable calm, which is a euphemism for a ceasefire. The word ceasefire would bring down the Netanyahu government.
Yeah, because it's loaded, because it would basically, they've been spinning for 6 months that a ceasefire would give Hamas the opportunity to regroup and launch fresh offensives, so they can't broach something, but they can consider something that it basically amounts to the same kind of a pause.
Yeah, so a situation where you have a conflict where 40,000 people have been killed in Gaza and you have people dying of famine is now resting on semantics by the Israeli government and the coalition that's been cobbled together there. So the US government is now at this point putting pressure on Israel to sign up to this. They have been party to these talks through William Burns, who's the CIA director. They have also got to a point now where they're not sending specific consignments of bombs to Israel because of what's happening in Rafah, with Israel going in with tanks. People will have seen the footage of tanks down at the Rafah crossing where, you know, people, it's the only way, it's the main way in and out of Rafah or of Gaza through to the Egyptian border. Tanks rolling over, signs saying Gaza. That border crossing has been cut. United Nations people saying effectively that the two main arteries in and out of Gaza have been choked, the life has been choked out of them. So this is a huge situation. It's been described as one of the darkest days of this conflict so far, given, as you say, the jubilation, the hope that was there that a ceasefire was almost within reach. And now it seems like it's a bit more open.
Can I ask you about this? Because you're better across the finer points of this than I am. But first of all, when you hear, maybe this is all spin, maybe this is a spin that was put out by the Hamas side that wasn't backed up by the neutral arbiters, Egypt and Qatar. But when you hear Hamas saying they've signed up to something, and then you hear that Israel is sending negotiators to those talks, that sort of implies that the talks are happening in a void because there was little or no Israeli representation there at all.
Yeah, this is the problem when you have a mediated thing and you don't have everybody around the same table.
Right.
As people might understand how talks go on, people think it's like you're on one side, I'm on the other side, and this is a conflict. We hash it out between ourselves. That's not how this has worked at all, because it's very hard to get Israel and Hamas.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you have intermediaries, you have places like the United States, you have Egypt, France has been involved to some degree as well. You have allies trying to egg Israel into accepting a position which they think would be, that's an easy off ramp. And you have, you know, places like Turkey, for example, and Egypt working with Hamas to try and, you know, dig a solution on their side. Now, the big thing which Israel has said for the last number of weeks and months is that Hamas is not signing up to any ceasefire. So Hamas's announcement over the weekend caught them completely off guard. That there was that for Hamas that there was an end to this conflict in sight. That's in terms of the information war, if you want to put it that way, that's a tough thing to get around. And Israel and Israeli politicians and the Israeli media are already out there saying, this is Hamas putting it on us, making it seem like we're being unreasonable and not accepting a ceasefire, when it's them who's being unreasonable because they're using it as a ruse. So it's all very complicated, but it is a difficult situation. It's only being compounded by the fact that you have 1.5 million people trapped in a tiny city. 600,000 of them are children. Little food, medicine, water, really desperate and increasingly bad humanitarian situation there.
And from the Israeli perspective, you talk about that word ceasefire almost being sort of that Netanyahu just cannot be seen to sort of sign up to it. But the one thing that really comes back time and time again for Israelis, the average Israeli person, is the hostages and the release of hostages. That's their priority.
Yeah, this is interesting because this is what it's going to be difficult for Israel to do. If they want to balance the idea of this being about the hostages, which is some part of the Israeli, you've seen, you know, hostages' families out protesting in Tel Aviv and the likes blocking roads saying, sign up to this deal, please. We want our family members home. A lot of them have already died since this war began. We would like our family members, if they're still alive, home. And if they're not alive, we want their bodies back as well. Mm. The harder line element of the Israeli government seems to be making this more about Hamas and ending this war and smashing all of Gaza than it is about returning hostages. And when you get down to the fact, because the easiest bits of this to negotiate are the hostages. They are the first thing, and they seem to be thing. All of the observers who are looking at this saying prisoner swap and hostage deal, that's the easiest thing to hammer out here. The rest and the toughest thing about this is everything that comes out after this, including who's responsible for reconstructing Gaza, how long a cessation of violence is going to last, all those stages. It's all that other stuff in it. So I think this is going to be a really difficult situation for Israel. The longer they don't sign up to a ceasefire to explain why exactly they're not, if they care about the hostages, if they care about people's lives.
It also strikes me that there's been some ambiguity on the Israeli side as to what the ultimate goal is, because you regularly hear, maybe not so much from Israel, but from its American allies and other sort of proxies for the Israeli view, that all of this could be over tomorrow if Hamas merely released the hostages and allowed them all to come home, that once they got their people back, everything could end. And, well, according to the Israeli government, that isn't quite the point, because isn't the point of this special military operation is to disarm and completely neutralise Hamas permanently? So merely returning the bodies and leaving some skeletal organisational framework of Hamas aside wouldn't accomplish the goal. Mm. If the point of doing everything that they've been doing in Gaza for the last 6 months is to do anything, it is to basically eliminate Hamas in perpetuity. And that's not achieved until, under that worldview, until they've done whatever it is that they want to do in Rafah or elsewhere. So the mere idea of getting the personnel back doesn't really achieve the purpose or doesn't fulfil the goal.
No, but as you say, in the meantime, then there are people who are trapped in Rafah who cannot get out, who cannot get across the border, who don't know if they're going to survive day to day, and that's the lived reality. And we're going to hear more about that later on in the podcast. But Richard, the Palestinian women's football team are in Dublin.
They're coming into Dublin. They're playing a much publicised game now against Bohemians women's team next week, this day next week, as we're recording on Wednesday. And it's just a fascinating story because the Palestinian women's team have never played a game in Europe. It's very difficult for women, particularly in Arab and Muslim nations, due to traditions and history, to get involved in sport at this level. And this is a really, really... There's some positive and really incredible stories in this team. So earlier on, I had an opportunity before work to have a Zoom with two members of the Palestinian women's team. Mira is the first person we'll hear from here. So she's the only girl in her family. She had four brothers. So that's where she learned the football from. She loved it from a young age. She found herself kicking a ball in the street. Tough as well. People's expectations, people staring at her, people trying to encourage her family to get her out of football. But her mom and her dad were very much like, no, you love football. You go away and play it. So here's a little bit of her experience. And also that perspective of what we've seen in Gaza over the last number of weeks and months. Sports stadiums, all sporting facilities in Gaza are wiped out. For a football mad place like Gaza and Palestine, every single last stadium is either being used for tents or it's been rubbled and bulldozed. So we had her perspective on that as well, but also her own story about getting into football.
The first thing that I can remember that I insist to my school teacher that I want to participate in the league, in the school league. I was the only girl in like 35 boys, and I got the top scorer in the league, competing with my brother. Then I engaged in my local club, DR, since age maybe 15, so like it's 10 years now. And I start playing with the Palestinian national team since 2018, so it's like been 6 years now. It was challenging at first, but now it is much like enjoyable. And also to mention that I'm also a medical doctor. I'm an intern. So it was really, really hard like phase. I have time that I have to choose between my medical study and also my sport. But I think that if I didn't play soccer, I wouldn't continue to be a doctor, because I used soccer as a source of escape from the pressure and from the study. I can see people all around the world, they are complaining about their lives, and they don't like this and they don't like this. But for me, every time I wake up, I thank God that I have limbs. This is the simplest way that I can thank God for. Like, I saw pictures on the news, children's, like adults, they don't have limbs. They don't have arms, they don't have legs. I can say brains out. And so I just thank God that I have a stadium, and I have a roof above me. I don't know if you see these pictures or even in the news, the Yarmouk Stadium in Gaza, they turned it into a place of like detention and violence and imprisonment.
So that's Mira's experience there as well, you know, working as a doctor, how football interacts with that, her own experiences, and having to see what's happening to, you know, other little girls who might want to be interested in football, who do not have that opportunity. So that's why they see this game as a huge, you know, moment for them, not just because, you know, it's them playing, but because there is this huge explosion in women's sport and women's football around the world. It's at a heightened popularity they've never seen before. Yeah. These guys, they only play in Gaza and they only play in the West Bank. They only play in Palestine. They don't really play. They don't have a showcase. They actually see this as a huge opportunity as well, that maybe, you know, Irish teams might go along to Dalymount Park and they say, oh, she's brilliant, let's have a look at her and see if we can get her a professional contract.
So it's kind of like a showcase for talent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a huge celebration as well. There's Palestinian food and there's Palestinian DJs as well. Like, there's a lot of Palestinian families who've gotten out of Gaza who'll actually be there as well on the night. Yeah. So it's interesting to sort of see that.
Can other people buy tickets for this, by the way?
Yeah, the tickets are still on sale. I think they were flying out, so I'm not sure there actually are any still
left
available.
Now.
So don't hold me to that. But Bisan is the other person who I was speaking to today, another fascinating person. They're both from Bethlehem in the West Bank. And Bisan just basically talked about how difficult it is to actually play for the Palestinian national team, how difficult it is based on living under occupation effectively, and what that means for people who might want to go to their games or even playing those games themselves.
You know, like, people risk it and come to watch our games because our stadiums are in hotspots. So we do have like the closest field to us, to me and Mira, is just like here, 10 minutes from where I am now. But unfortunately, around it, there are a lot of settlements. And then a lot of the IDF are always around that area. So one time, yeah, and also like the main stadium in Ramallah, in like close to a village beside Ramallah. Also, it's located in a very, in an area where IDF are always around that place. So I remember the last season in the semifinal, we were playing there, we were on the field, we were just warming up, and then they had like tear bombs all around the field, the stadium, and then none of us was able to breathe. So it was very difficult to continue, to start the game and then to even continue, because, I mean, you know, like playing 90 minutes is tough itself, and then playing 90 minutes, like with the effect of tear gas is bad. So we did stay, and then we waited a bit, and then we continued our game because, like, we're used to this. We're used to like being bombed and having things happening at night, but then in the morning we would go to work. You know, this is it in Palestine. So yes, this was, you know, like, so we've had those things before the 7th of October, and then after the 7th of October now, none of the leagues in any sport, any gender, none of it, nothing is happening.
So that's just a flavour as well, that it isn't just in Gaza that all life, normal life, has come to an end in terms of Palestinian people. It's happening in the West Bank as well. There's some excellent reports, you know, from Channel 4 and New York Times about how life has changed in the West Bank, which are worth following up. So sport is one escape for people which has been, you know, robbed from them. So maybe in some ways this match happening next week is a way to sort of engage with that. And it is a nice moment, you know, amidst all of the heartache and all of the loss we've seen over the last number of months.
Now, we're joined in studio by Khaled El Astal, whose father and brothers are still in Rafah trying to get out. Your brothers, Khaled, are Irish passport holders. Your father is a dependent and has permission to essentially leave Rafah. But for whatever reason, they have not been able to get out. Have you had a chance to speak to them in the last couple of days?
Actually, yeah, I had a chance to speak with them, not actually the last couple of days. So, you know, the IDF, like, is now in Rafah, or they're now in Rafah. So I didn't speak with them after that. But like before it, like last week was the last time when I spoke with them. And they were worried about what happened already now. Like the Israeli being in Rafah, it means that we don't know when the border will be open again. So yeah, that was the last chat between us. Yeah.
So you might just take us back to the beginning of all of this for you, October 7th, yeah. For you and your family. You were working away, sending money home to your family. That's at the time. Right. How did the situation unfold for you?
So yeah, I was, you know, after the 7th of October, I was contacting everyone to try get my family out. And, you know, she was alive. That was my priority. And with the help, like my friend Fred, who's from the US and he worked with my wife, we're trying to do something to take my family out. And suddenly, like, it was the 22nd or the 23rd of October when my friend who was at the hospital, who actually lost his wife and two children, and his dad, he was with his dad, he was injured and then he passed away. And his sister, he's very close to me, he was in the hospital. And then when he sent me a photo of Ali and Sara, they were injured, my children. And Ali was crying, there was a video when he was crying actually about his mom. So that was like the first time. And he after that, he said, like, I don't know what happened. We don't know who's alive and who's dead. Or try, like, they're trying to take the people from under the rubbles. So, yeah. And then he told me that my mom was killed. My brother after that, my uncle and his family, all of them. And then my wife, she was injured. She was actually badly injured. Like she was totally burned, like 70%, the doctor said. Yeah, she was there at the hospital for 10 days. I was in Saudi Arabia working, and then I left to Turkey to be with my cousins. I was hoping that we will get her here. At least, you know, there was a hope that she's still alive. That's a good thing. I was very happy, you know, there is a happiness between, you know, among this sadness that she is still alive. I was thinking about like plastic surgeries and, you know, giving her a good life. She will never think about anything. But like in the 1st of November, she passed away after 10 days, not 10 days, like 9 or 8 days. She passed away. I came here, and that was a good decision to do, like coming to Ireland. Was everyone was very, very supportive. Everyone helped me as much as they can. And we tried everything to get the kids, and the kids finally came, but sadly not with their mom. They came with their uncle, my brother-in-law, who is like with me right now. So yeah, we're living here in Dublin.
How are your kids now, Alice?
Yeah, they're doing good. Like, they're doing good. You know, before they were injured. And even like I was saying last time that Sarah, one of my cousins, he told me that him and his mom, they were looking at the rubble. And she was saying that there is a cat moving under the rubble. And he went to like to help the cat. And it wasn't the cat. It was my daughter, Sarah. And she's only 1.5 years. And they fall, like three of them, with my mom from the 3rd floor. So my mom passed away and they survived. It's a miracle. So Sarah was like, she had the burns and she still have scars and her skull was broken and there was bleeding inside. So yeah, compared to what they were, like now they're very good. And thanks for the people who are like helping, you know, here we have a real family. Like there is so many people who are, for my kids, they're like uncles and maybe even more. But sometimes, you know, like especially Ali, who remember his mom, it's not easy. He's sometimes asking me when she will come back. I'm trying to explain for him that she's dead. He don't understand what's the meaning of death. Sometimes he's telling me there is a cartoon I watch that there is a light coming from sky and then she's alive. Someone is alive again. We can do the same for my mom. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he don't, like, he's in the age that he don't get it, like, still having nightmares, but generally, like, you know, they're settling and trying to do the best.
When you're thinking so much about trying to get them home and looking after yourself and your other family members that you're trying to get out of there into safety, do you have time, or have you had time to grieve yourself?
That's a big question, because that's a problem. Like, me myself, I think until now, I don't understand. I don't believe what happened. Like, I've been through a lot. Like, I'm thinking until now, I'm thinking about so many people in Gaza. Like, I lost, like, even since what happened to my family, I lost so many family members. They're very good friends. They're very close. Like, they're cousins and uncles and things like this. And when sometimes, especially at night, when I think about, she's not here. There's the things that, like, I used to share with her. So sometimes I speak with her until now, like, I send her WhatsApps and things. I don't think my mind is accepting. Maybe, like, so it's very painful sometimes when you understand that she's gone. And it's not only my wife, like, it's my brother and my mom. My brother who we shared the same room for 25 years. And my mom, you know, she's my mom. She's my everything. So yeah, even because of like everything, the number of people you lost, you don't even have the chance to focus on someone, to focus, think about it properly.
You have lost so many people, Khaled, and your father and your brothers still have a chance. What support are you getting in terms of foreign affairs? Are people helping you to try and get them out through that Rafah crossing? Obviously, it is a lot more challenging now that Israel has taken over the border crossing.
Yeah. So yeah, for this problem is a very big problem for me right now. I think it's the thing that I think about it the most, because of my we didn't imagine that we would reach to this stage. So it's like now 6 months, and we're like, everyone was saying that we're trying our best to, and we were like thinking, okay, it will be next month or something like that. But now it's like 6 months, and things are very bad to the level, like, in the last month when I speak with my dad, the man who was very strong, the man, like, he didn't show us any weaknesses in his life. When you want to speak about something, when you're about to ask about something, you go to him. And now he's like begging me every time to do something where I can't do anything. So I'm trying to contain, like, to contact the foreign affairs, and they're saying they're doing their best. What I did now is, like, I'm trying to, I started a fundraiser campaign on GoFundMe to, you know, to collect money to bring them back. Which is, that's why my dad, he's all the time telling me that there's a lot of people who paid money and they're out. Why won't you do this? And the problem that I can't do anything, I'm trying to do everything, but it's very difficult. And this feeling when you're helpless, when you can't do the thing that your father, yeah, like, he's my father, like, he's my idol, like, and you can't do anything for him. And sometimes I avoid, like, speaking with him. And which is very bad. Like, I can't describe the feeling. Mm. So yeah, I started a fundraiser. I think it will that will be very good in the state that will Rafah crossing board will be open.
How did it make you feel then in that regard when you see the footage from the last 24, 48 hours and you see Israeli tanks at the Rafah crossing running over signs which say Gaza?
Yeah.
I mean, how does that make you feel when you get to that point?
Like, I can't even describe what I feel, because, like, my father, he was like, for the last, especially for the last 2 months, he was all the time, when they say that one day they will be in Rafah, he was all the time just begging me. Imagine, like, my dad, who never asked me for anything, he's begging me for the first time, you know, about to cry, and he's saying, please do something for us, because if the military is in Rafah, he will never be able to go out. And they're not suffering only, you know, they're not suffering only from, like, that they don't have food and things like this. You're talking about they lost, like, my daddy lost his wife, his son, his brother, and his brother's family, cousins, and my wife as well. She was the only girl in the family, and she was, like, exactly like his daughter. And now when you see the things like that happening in Rafah, That's unbelievable. All the people will be pushed to the place that my dad lives, and he's not living like it, they're like near the sea in a tent. And I saw I saw a photo for my dad for the first time in 6 months. Really, for the first time, I didn't see any photo from him because they lost their phones and they don't have a smartphone even. And he looks like at least 10 years older. So this situation, everything, and especially what happened in Rafah, it's unbelievable, yeah.
It's obviously complex in the situation of your father because he's not an Irish citizen, although he is a dependent, and other Irish citizens that were leaving were able to bring dependents with them. Do you worry that when there was so much movement about getting Irish citizens out last November, you know, the Alaga family among them, that maybe some of the energy that's gone into trying to get Irish citizens out has ebbed away, and that maybe the government has sort of lost its attention on the Irish citizens that are still there?
Actually, well, I spoke with them, like with the government, for many times. Even me and Martin, we met him himself, and they're saying all the time that they're trying them, you know, their best. So I can't, like, the people who I spoke with, they were saying that I can't decide if they really, you know, lost attention to this case. But we're doing I'm doing the least that I can do is to apply pressure on them, even if they are like doing their best, because like they are their responsibility. They are Irish citizens, and they are their responsibility. They're in a very, very bad situation.
Can I ask this before we go? Obviously, this is you know, a huge amount of toll that's taken out of you. I mean, your wife, what your kids have been through, what your family's going through now as well. Who's looking after you in this situation? I mean, I hope you have time as well, because you're in a situation with such pressure on yourself, and you're having those phone calls with your dad.
As I told you, like it's the people here, the Irish amazing people. Like I can't imagine myself anywhere but here in Ireland. So I have a big family right now, and they're like taking care of me, taking care of the kids. They're very, very supportive. So even like I left home now, and like there is John, my friend, he's from Kildare, and he's taken Ellie to like a playground. And there is like my brother-in-law, I told you, he came with the kids. So he's very giving us a support. But still, you know, it's not easy. Still, there's nights when you die a million times during the night. You're alone, and it's not still very difficult. So I hope we'll get my family. I hope like if anyone can help with the fundraiser or anything like this, it will be amazing, because like really we're feeling desperate and helpless.
Khaled, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. And, you know, just to say, I suppose I've met your children, Ali and Sarah. Yeah. They are beautiful children. They are such a credit to you. And I know that, you know, Ali is in play school now, and he's doing really, really well. But it has been such a difficult time for you, and we really hope that you're reunited with your father and brothers.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your kindness. Yeah, thank you very much.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, the path forward for the state broadcaster has been somewhat laid out, Gavin, this week with a number of reports.
Yeah, somewhat. There were three reports published by the Cabinet on Tuesday, two sanctioned by the Cabinet itself, and then one undertaken by the accountants Mazars into that old infamous barter account. There's a 2023 word you didn't think you were going to be hearing more of again.
Barter accountant, having
it's basically the wet pubs of 2023. So these reports were published by the cabinet on Tuesday, and they do lay out something of a plan for RTE, because nothing that RTE was already doing is going to be stopped or kiboshed by these. But they do lay out, I think, 116 recommendations in total for how RTE should be reformed or how its governance should improve in future. Some of those recommendations are for government as well. Like, kind of lost in the weeds on Tuesday was the declaration that the government had actually been a bit lax by allowing some vacancies on the RTE board to hang on for ages, or that there wasn't very much attention paid to making sure that the RTE board had the expertise they'd need to do the job. They weren't appointing accountants, they weren't appointing people with certain familiarities or strengths or fortes or whatnot. So a lot of what they're already doing internally is going to happen anyway. I think the most striking thing, really, and we might see the washout of this coming in months to come, is that the what were called until last summer the talent, who up until now were able to negotiate their own pay deals, are now not alone going to be capped at €250,000, the same as the director general earns, but they're also going to have to be on public sector style pay scales, where if you are appointed to a particular prominent on-air role, you will be told, this is your pay scale. You can get basically increments where the longer you stay, the slightly longer it will get. But that there's a real transparency to it, so you're not going to be able to do a bespoke deal. An interesting
side... So your agent can't come in and negotiate a better sort of deal.
An interesting side note to that is that they are apparently open now to allowing agents to remain a part of this, because you might remember last summer there was this push to remove the likes of the Noel Kellys of the world from having any interface in RTE. There was this attitude that all of the on-air presenters should actually be RTE staff rather than being outside contractors who sort of have this arm's length relationship. That apparently now is more tolerable, but they're now saying that agents can have this role. But what are you going to negotiate if, in fact, there is a publicly stipulated pay deal? One other interesting note, though, I said there was a kind of a caveat about whether there is a path forward. These are the last bits of the jigsaw, if you like, so that the government can now make decisions about how RTE and, by extension, other media will be funded into the future. And they've committed to making that decision before the dole rises for the summer break, so in the next 2 months or so.
Well, basically in a couple of weeks, really.
Possibly so. No, not this side of the local elections, but it will happen sometime in late June or early July. The difficulty is that if you change the TV licence at all, or if you change how it's collected or whatever it is, that requires changing the law. And we are getting into the weeds of the final hours on the clock of this government, where they could be gone after the budget and they will certainly be gone just after Christmas. And there are so many other things they also need to change about RTE, like, for example, making the Comptroller and Auditor General, giving them authority over RTE. There's so much to do that actually, even if the government makes a decision about the future of the TV licence, might not actually get implemented this side of a general election, because you have to change the law and there's just so much stuff to do before the clock runs out on the government. So you could have a situation where the government says, right, we're abolishing the TV licence, or we are reducing the TV licence, or we're changing how it's structured, but actually they might not get around to making those changes.
It becomes the responsibility of the next all.
And then you have this conversation where Sinn Féin say you should just abolish the TV licence altogether, or you have it becoming a political football in the middle of the next government talks, which might not be the best thing for RTE or for any other media outlet, but that's likely what we're looking at now because the clock is running down.
Yeah, and I suppose when you have, you know, the heaviness of all of these different reports and, you know, tomes published yesterday, plus then you were into the immediate thing around the funding model and what's the future for the TV licence, you can actually lose sight of some of the detail in it. So there was some, in terms of the actual findings through the Mazars report and whatnot, hard copy of barter transactions for the period of 2017-2019 lost.
In an office move.
During an office move. That's great. No valid basis for €150,000 payment to Tuberty through the barter account. €25,000 spent on client entertainment at a Jenny Green concert.
How much?
€25,000.
At a Jenny Green concert.
At the Three
Arena. Which they were already running anyway.
Yeah.
How did it cost €25,000 to bring people to a concert with someone that works for you?
One interesting side note to all the barter stuff, they found €654,000 of subsistence and travel, which had been put through the barter account, which wasn't otherwise known about until now. So when they were putting together an end of year picture of what was spent on hospitality and whatnot, these things weren't included, which actually kind of means that the government was misled about the extent of spending there, and it's kind of gone under the radar till now.
Wow. Tell us about how to vote, Gavin, or how not to vote.
Because Here's how to vote.
Before we wrap up this part, Gavin, this is Gavin's big thing.
I was going back and looking at my notes from the 2019 elections, and I came across this point, which was very big for a few hours and was forgotten about. So almost everyone who is voting on June the 7th will be presented with two ballot papers. And in fact, if you're in Limerick, chances are you'd be presented with three. And it turns out what a lot of people did, which you're not supposed to do, but was accepted practice until recently enough, was that if you were given two or three ballot papers, you might have two ballot papers beside each other and you might say one, two, three, four, five, six, and you might treat your two ballot papers as if they were basically one and the same, as if it was a single batch of candidates, even though it was two different sets of candidates for two separate elections. And up until 2014, that was fine, because although it's unorthodox, if a returning officer picked up the ballot paper that had numbers 2, 4, 6, and 8 on it, although there wasn't a number one, it was clear that you had an order of preference for the candidates on the page. They would say, well, number two has the lowest number here.
But then when it came down to transfers, that's when the twos would become important.
Well, no, because then if you've already processed the two, then you just go to the next available number. Mm-hmm. So it was always treated as if it was.
So basically, if you voted 2-4, it wouldn't have counted in a transfer anyway, because it was just like writing down.
It didn't matter really what numbers you were there. Yeah. They would still treat it as if it were 1, 2, 3, 4.
The spirit it was intended would be accepted.
Precisely.
Okay.
The Supreme Court intervened after a challenge in 2014 and said, no, you can't do that. And no one ever then changed the law to undo that. So actually, about 1 in 25 votes in the local and European elections in Dublin in 2019 ended up being invalid because somebody had picked up the two ballot papers and they'd gone 1, 2, 3, 4 across the two ballots.
Or
they might have said 1, 2, 3, 4 on one page and then 5, 6, 7, 8 on another. And the Supreme Court said, well, by the letter of the law, if there isn't a number one on this page, we can't accept it.
I agree with that too.
That it shouldn't be valid if it doesn't have a number one.
The basis of that vote or those votes is like,
even though the voter had a clear set of preferences as to who they preferred.
But the preference is only there. Like, if you count that they're looking at both sets of candidates in two different elections, like, it doesn't make any sense.
What I'm trying to say is, when you go into the ballot box to vote, you're going to have one page for the locals, you're going to have one page for the Europeans,
and you may have one for Limerick as well.
Treat them as two completely separate entities.
And select one to whatever number as separate entities.
And moreover, this is the reason why we're saying it a month ahead of time, tell any older relatives who may be confused that is what you have to do. Because if they go in, and no one realised how common this was until the elections 5 years ago, but if you count a single set of preferences across both ballot papers, one of the ballot papers won't count, and it's possible neither will count. So tell your older relatives, each paper in isolation, start each one of the number one, and treat them all as if they're unique.
Sage advice. Thanks for that, Gav.
There you go.
Well, it's very exciting. For the first time since 2018, Ireland has made it into the final of the Eurovision Song Contest, and we are delighted for Bambi Thog. We're furthermore delighted to be joined on the line from Malmö in Sweden by Micheál O'Kane, who is from Eurovision Hub, the fan site. Micheál, you're in Malmö. How's it all going over there?
The atmosphere is electric. Like, we're not greeting Irish fans by saying hello anymore. We're just shouting, crown the witch, crown the witch. It's such an unusual feeling because we usually just come up and we're just there to take part. But now we're really present. We're competing. We've showed up, and it's an unusual feeling for us. So it's very exciting.
And it seems, Micheál, there is a real attitude to crown the witch, because I think I saw some audience polls or some press polls to suggest that Bambi was either the favourite or the second favourite going into last night's semi-final.
Yeah, this is a real conversation to be having. I mean, on the train here, the thought was, oh, can we qualify? It would be great if we could qualify. Then we watched the dress rehearsal, and within a matter of hours, Ireland had jumped to fifth. And the odds, we had won the press poll, which sees around 400 to 500 international media outlets vote for who they thought had the best rehearsal, and Ireland won it. And I was like, jeekers, like this. On Twitter, I was like, is this a serious, how you can get like hoaxes and stuff? But it turned out to be true. And then they do an exit poll after the public rehearsal, and we came second in that. And so it's a real conversation to be having. And even now, we're still at fifth after last night. So it's a real thing. The excitement's real.
A lot of the talking points over here have been about whether it's appropriate for Bambi to even be participating in the Eurovision because of the stance that Bambi has taken about what's going on in Gaza. And we know that in the last 36 hours or so, there's been a lot of over and back with the EBU, even about the OM lettering on the side of their face. How much of a conversation point has that been in Sweden? And is Ireland alone in having this national conversation around whether it's even appropriate to be taking part?
Ireland's not alone in the conversation. Bambi, alongside some of the other artists this year, made a statement expressing their point of view on it. And here in Sweden, it definitely is a conversation that's been happening. But it's the Musical Olympics. At the Olympics, you have high security. At UEFA, you'll have high security. The World Cup, And Eurovision is no different, but there is a high police presence. There's security around here, but it's no different than it was in Liverpool last year. You know, like I said, this is the most watched non-sporting TV program in the world. You got like around 200 million people watching. You know, this is a big deal. So like any big other major event, there will be high security, and this year is no different.
Just for people who might have missed it in terms of the semi-final last night. So Bambi Thug had lettering saying ceasefire and freedom on their face in Ulm script, told by the EBU and the Swedish broadcasters to change that to Crown the Witch, which of course has become basically the message for Bambi Thug and the campaign to win Eurovision for Ireland again. Also, the Swedish entrant, who his father is Palestinian, I think I understand. He wore a kafayah scarf, the Palestinian sort of scarf, around his wrist, and he's been told off about that as well. So there are protests taking place. I mean, do you think that when the final does happen on Saturday, that there will be little glimpses of the politics of all this when it does come down to it?
I don't think during the broadcast, but we have heard that protests have been planned here in Malmö. Demonstrations have been planned, and police are aware of it, so hopefully they'll be carried out safely and in a manner that is suitable and secure for everybody attending. But I've been here since Saturday, and I've seen nothing of the sort. Maybe it's a bit too early in the week, but for me, this is the familiar, safe space that I'm used to. Maybe it's just the areas that I've been in, but I haven't seen anything out of the ordinary yet. But like I said, it's still early in the week, and it could be closer to the weekend that we see stuff like that happen. But we have heard that it's planned.
Michal, so first time to get to the final since 2018. This is obviously huge. Can you just tell us, you know, what it is you think is different about Ireland's entry this year, and why has it been so successful this time around?
We've taken a risk. We're showing Ireland in 2024. We're showing that we are a nation that's progressive, a nation that's open. And this is the Ireland that I recognize. This is the Ireland that I resonate with. And I'm so proud that it's Ireland that has a non-binary artist on stage. And it sends out a strong message to the Irish public and to RT. And it says, you know, hard work gets rewarded. And Bambi has worked very, very hard on this performance with the small team and small resources that they had. And the result is this. Is this momentum going around Europe? And you see it reflected in the YouTube views and streams and online conversations. And there's even a feeling that the Irish public are like, oh, wait, like something's happening. And that's exciting.
I saw a clip of their mother from the news, I think it was last night, and they were obviously so incredibly proud. Is there, you mentioned there, you know, limited resources. Is there a big team with Bambi on the ground there in Malmö, or, you know, give us a flavour of, you know, the type of support, I suppose, they have in terms of this busy, busy week?
Yeah, so obviously they're supported by RT. You got the head of delegation and media, heads of media and stuff like that. But Bambi's creative team is very small. I think it's people that they've worked with throughout their career. And they've just used all the creativity that they've got and put it into the performance. They said at the press conference they're very supported by RTE, but there's always room for improvements. It's what Bambi said last night during the press conference.
Lay your cards on the table, Michal. What do we have to do to beat Baby Lasagna? Because this Croatian favourite really seems like it's going to go all the way.
Yes, it got momentum at the start of the season. It was favoured to win. And then Nemo, the second non-binary artist of the competition this year, overtook. But once we saw Nemo's dress rehearsal, Nemo dropped, and now Croatia's back. I think Croatia's rise in odds is because Ukraine has drifted a bit. And as countries drift, then the one position becomes a bit stronger. So we just have to keep doing what we're doing. We're gaining momentum at the right time, at the right pace. Things are just slotting in line. And it feels mad to even be having this conversation, because we think about last year, and this year is just... Is it the same Ireland? Is it us? You know what I mean? So, like I said, it just goes to show that hard work gets rewarded and effort gets rewarded.
Well, we're going to be watching very closely on Saturday night. Michal O'Kane, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the week in Sweden.
Thank you so much.
Now, before we go, more music news. Richard, why are Drake and Kendrick Lamar fighting?
Complicated, but it is the biggest thing to happen.
I'm going to need a 60-second summary on why this is happening.
The biggest thing to happen to hip-hop music, and probably music in general, in a long, long time. Kendrick Lamar is Not Like Us, which people might have heard, is now the biggest single-day streaming hip-hop song in US Spotify history. And it is a song in which, and Drake has denied all of this, there are serious allegations against Drake levelled in this song in what is going to be the song of the summer. So this has already got people like Billboard magazine. So, okay, just to set the scene in this. Kendrick Lamar is the critical darling. Drake is probably the most successful mainstream hip-hop artist of all time, which is something which grinds a lot of people the wrong way. They have not liked each other for at least a decade or more. They have occasionally referenced each other on the sly, little digs at each other for a long time. It's gone quiet for a few years, but it's burst into life all because of another artist called J. Cole, who described himself, Kendrick and Drake, as the big three, as in the big three biggest rappers in the world, and then quickly dived out of the scene as the two of them obliterated each other across seven, eight, or nine tracks.
Set fire to the bridge and drove away, and that was it.
Incredibly so, and there's been all sorts of allegations in it. There's been incredible songs out of it. So the good thing about this is that it's probably brought the best out of Drake and Kendrick Lamar in a long, long time. The downside is that there's all sorts of wild allegations been thrown around against each other, and that these are grown-ass men who are taking shots at each other in songs.
So is ultimately the thing is, one is the critic's choice and one is the commercial darling, and they're both kind of feuding over who then therefore is the best or most accomplished act.
Kind of is that. But there's downright hatred in it as well. And a lot of it comes down to, and Kendrick Lamar has released, I mean, all music magazines, I think the public, even Drake fans would admit that Kendrick Lamar has actually won this battle. So this is already all over.
But the streets are talking. I mean, I was walking through a village in West Cork at the weekend and I heard someone having a discussion about whether they were Team Drake or Team Kendrick Lamar. So people are invested.
And it is. And it's rare for something like this to happen, where now you are having places like Billboard magazine writing articles saying, how does Drake actually survive this? Because Drake has long been pointed out, he's a Canadian, right?
Is this a serious body blow to Drake?
This is genuinely is, because you have a lot of people who previously worked with Drake who've now abandoned him, have basically called him a culture vulture, that he takes little bits. He puts on accents from places like grime music in London. He takes little bits of rap and music from all different sorts of...
So Drake is a construct. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Which is obviously, you know, it's a very powerful sort of criticism. Plus the fact that he's had to release songs saying, I am not into underage girls, which is effectively what he's had to do, which is a very difficult thing for any artist of that scale to have to do. And to release a song denying that is, yeah, it's his credibility is very, very difficult to sort of see enduring.
Not since Lauren and Heidi have we had an American culture war that has divided the world.
I want to
so
forgive
much.
You and I want to forget you.
There you go.
Said well, Lauren Conrad to Heidi. On that note, thank you so much for joining the group chat this week. I've been Zara King. This has been Richard Chambers and Gavin Riley.
Goodbye, everyone.
And we'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.